This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the world's biggest corporation has chosen its two new headquarters cities, but some folks want Amazon to go back where it came from. We'll hear from a Muslim liberation theologian who says Islam should be on the side of the poor and oppressed. And Mumia Abu-Jamal files a report for Prison Radio. But first, the Republican Party lost control of the U.S. House in the recent elections, but strengthened its hold on the Senate. Historically speaking, President Trump's party was not beaten as badly as Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama were in midterm elections. We spoke with Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific author and activist who teaches history and African American studies at the University of Houston.
Well, it was a mixed bag. As you suggest, in 1994, Bill Clinton lost about four dozen seats in the House and the Senate. In 2010, Barack Obama lost about five dozen seats in the House and the Senate. It appears, as of our speaking, that the 45th U.S. president will lose about three dozen seats in the House and perhaps have a gain in the Senate. It's also, at least according to the Guardian of London, that Mr. Trump won the all-important vote defined as white by 10 points, which gives him more leverage than the pundits seem to recognize, because in this country, if you win the so-called white vote, that's more valuable in some ways than winning the overall vote. It's like in Israel, for example, where it's not enough to push something through to have a Knesset majority. You have to have a Jewish majority within the Knesset. That is to say, rendering, as we know, the 20% of the population that's Arab and Palestinian as being less than. And that's a reality that many in this country find it difficult to grasp, because they have this dewy-eyed, ideally romanticized view of the construction of this former slaveholders' republic based upon mass dispossession of the indigenous. Having said that, it is apparent that Mr. Trump feels that he is cornered. However, a beast, when he is cornered, is even more dangerous, I'm afraid to say. And therefore, you can expect a rocky road ahead, perhaps signaled the day after the midterms, when there was the forced resignation of the Attorney General, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, and his replacement by the wildly incompetent Matt Whitaker. Mr. Whitaker is presently under fire, which may delay what many of us expected, that he will move to replace and or reduce the effectiveness of the special counsel, Mr. Mueller. By the latter, I mean shrinking his budget, for example. But as we know, Mr. Mueller, it has been reported, has been passing on evidence of the alleged misdeeds of Mr. Trump to the New York State Attorney General's office, amongst others. And that office, as you know, is now headed by Tish James, a Black woman who is no friend of Mr. Trump. And apparently he's been passing on evidence to the Southern District of New York, which in a sense is under his jurisdiction, Mr. Trump's jurisdiction, because we're talking about federal prosecutors. But it's not clear if that'll be meaningful if they decide to move forward, just like they move forward against Mr. Trump's fixer, Michael Cohen. So in many ways, this election may have more impact on foreign policy than domestic policy. That is to say, as you know, in Washington, amongst the U.S. ruling elite, there's this mania for what they call bipartisanship. That is to say, the Democrats and the Republicans joining hands. And I'm afraid to say that that will probably occur with regard to policy concerning China. Sherrod Brown, who's already being touted, interestingly enough, as a presidential candidate, he won his reelection race for the Senate in Ohio by about 10 points and has a reputation as being close to unions, is hawkish on the question of China, in some ways outstripping Mr. Trump. And you can expect that kind of so-called bipartisanship with regard to China, which is quite dangerous given the fact that their navies are jousting in the South China Sea. And given the fact that in a remarkable speech that did not receive much publicity, Peter Navarro, the White House economic advisor and anti-China hawk, accused a number of Wall Street titans. Implicitly, he was speaking of Stephen Schwarzman, part of the 0.0001%. He says that they're unpaid agents of China because they're lobbying the White House with regard to this ill-advised trade war. It's interesting that some decades ago, you had communists being accused of being agents of Moscow, and now you have Wall Street titans being accused of being agents of so-called communist China. It's quite a remarkable turn of events.
That is fascinating because some people interpret what the Trump administration is doing with China as actually an attack on multinational corporate supply chains, those chains that reach deep into not just China, but lots of the global South to harness low-wage labor, and that Trump wants to disrupt those supply chains. But that would be an assault on, well, as formidable a power structure as one can imagine, multinational capital.
Well, that is true. And that's why we need a deeper analysis of this Trump phenomenon. I tend to agree with those who have suggested that there's a stench of fascism in the air. I would also say that there's a stench of counter-revolution in the air, particularly counter-revolution against whatever gains may have been made in recent decades by the population of African descent. And if those kinds of musings are accurate, then we can't necessarily rule out the possibility that these multinational giants, including Stephen Schwarzman and his comrades in Microsoft and GM, KFC and Starbucks, all of which are heavily invested in China, not to mention Apple, having to take a haircut or worse. And obviously this helps to explain the kind of internecine conflict at the highest levels of the U.S. ruling elite, which you see played out every night on cable news, on CNN and MSNBC to a certain degree. And then there's the question of Iran. Recall that just a few days ago, Mr. Trump tightened sanctions against Iran, but these sanctions will probably not be followed by China nor Russia, probably not India, which in any case has gotten a waiver. The European Union is supposedly developing a special purpose vehicle by which it can circumvent the use of the U.S. dollar in terms of its dealings with Iran, not to mention the international banking system, which is dominated by the so-called SWIFT system, SWIFT, which is dominated by the United States. Now, recall that the Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer, opposed avidly the Iranian nuclear deal, which Mr. Trump has called the worst deal ever, and which has led to his tightening sanctions against Iran. With regard to the aforementioned point, mania for bipartisanship in Washington, you can well expect that there will be a push towards so-called bipartisanship with regard to dealing with Iran, which I might say is quite dangerous. It's quite dangerous not only because of what's happening in that immediate vicinity, that is to say the United States' rather nefarious aims in Syria, meeting bruising resistance from the Syrians and their Iranian and Russian comrades, but also in Afghanistan, where the situation is deteriorating rapidly, and it seems that the United States might be on the verge of a helter-skelter retreat from Afghanistan, not unlike what happened in Vietnam in April 1975. This would obviously compromise the attempt to crack down on Iran, but I'm afraid to say that many of our pundits and commentators are not focused on this dire crisis.
Yes, and since Donald Trump is not wedded politically to the war in Afghanistan, that makes the prospect of a U.S. exit much more plausible.
Oh, it certainly does. And this is also playing out against the backdrop of U.S. maneuvering concerning its longtime relationship with Pakistan and its recent attempt to woo India. Now, keep in mind that for the longest in Washington, there has been the notion floated that the problem in Afghanistan is really a Pakistani problem. The idea is floated that the resistance to the Kabul regime would be lessened if Pakistan stopped interfering in the internal affairs of Afghanistan. This is taking place at the same time that in an attempt to encircle China, the United States is seeking to woo India, witness the waiver that India has received concerning being able to thumb its nose and tighten sanctions against Iran. Now, given the increasing discontent with Pakistan, that probably suggests even further that the United States might not only be on the verge of a helter-skelter retreat from Afghanistan. Of course, I'll note in this context your perceptive comment concerning Mr. Trump. But it also suggests that the United States could be on the verge of a defeat with regard to its 17-year attempt to install a puppet regime in Kabul. And I might also say, and I've said this before, that in some ways the situation in Afghanistan, I'm afraid to say, resembles that in the United States. What I mean is, let me say this quickly, is that before the rise of the Taliban, the United States did a very deft and expert job in strangling the left in Kabul. Recall the execution, lynch-style, Jim Crow-style, Najibur, the last progressive leader of Afghanistan, with U.S. pundits and commentators applauding. Then that leads to the rise of the Taliban. And now the United States is discontented with those erstwhile comrades in who they collaborated with, including, I should say, Osama bin Laden himself, and destabilizing that left-wing regime. But the parallel with the United States is that I think that the preceding epic, the Red Scare Cold War epic, the United States did a demolition job against the U.S. left, radicals generally. Witnessed the executions of Black Panther Party leaders, for example, the jailing of other radicals, the driving into deportation of people like Ferdinand Smith, the leading black trade unionist, number two of the National Maritime Union, which he helped to organize, the attempt to deport Harry Bridges, the West Coast longshore leader who was very close to the Black Liberation Movement. Now, the United States, I think one of the reasons that it's suffering so grievously, particularly ideologically, is because of what it did in the preceding epic, the Red Scare Cold War epic, which, as you know, pundits refuse to critique. They see that as the shining out of the United States, which is ironic indeed.
So you seem to be saying that what's wrong with the U.S. polity is a state-induced deficit of radical politics.
Well, certainly. I think that that's what leads the U.S. ruling class to continually get involved in these fiascos and debacles, because there has been such an expert and deftly executed job of squashing a certain point of view that the political spectrum in the United States is tipped unduly towards the center right, and it unduly tends to exclude other points of view, which means that on the paramount issues of war and peace, oftentimes the impulse is towards war, not peace. And that has led to debacles in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and other countries too numerous to mention.
What gets me is how this corporate media doesn't reflect any recognition of how after 2 years of this most profound split in the ruling class, with most of the corporate media being on the other side of Trump, it's Trump and anti-Trump now, that there basically has been no significant erosion, measurable erosion, in his white supremacist bloc. It appears to me that that bloc has in fact become more politically coherent and confident under Trump, with Trump as its champion, and that this is very, very significant.
I think one of the most significant developments of the past week was this demonstration in Warsaw, Poland, of hundreds of thousands of people ostensibly marching in favor of the centennial of Polish independence, but it's turned into a white power, the biggest white power rally on earth. And what's even more remarkable is that Poland, as you know, does not have, it turned its back, unlike Germany, on accepting refugees from Africa and the Arab world, et cetera. And yet you have this massive white power march, white power rally, fascist rally, in fact, at the same time that just a few weeks ago, a Polish leader came to the White House and offered to establish a U.S. base in Poland that would be called Fort Trump. And recall that Mr. Trump gave one of his most highly touted speeches in Poland. And so you have the United States, which is in the vanguard of collaborating with these neo-fascist forces, be they in Brazil or Poland or Italy. Recall that his ambassador to Germany, Richard Grenell, suggested that Chancellor Merkel was too far to the left and that he would be collaborating with forces to her right. This is something, once again, that I don't think the pundit class has paid careful attention to, because in some ways, and not to mention our friends on the left, because it contradicts their rather dewy-eyed, unduly romanticized view of the United States, which they don't necessarily see as being the leading vector for neo-fascism.
Yes, what does white supremacy mean in Poland, where there are very few people that we would not call white? Is this a mimicry, or who is the other that these Poles are so afraid of?
Well, that's what I mean. I think that they're basically auditioning to be a puppet for Washington. And they're mimicking ideas that have been mainlined directly from Washington. And that's what's so dire about the situation, because I think as well that that kind of international situation would put wind in the sails of Mr. Trump, who you've already suggested has a so-called white bloc that is not deteriorating in the least. And if you look historically in the United States, and once again speaking from Oxford, Mississippi, the victim of these white power upsurges are those who tend to be melanin rich.
That was Dr. Gerald Horn speaking from Houston. Amazon, the biggest corporation in the world, owned by Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world, has decided to move its second corporate headquarters to the power cities of New York and Washington, D.C. Cities and states across the country had promised Amazon billions of dollars in tax incentives and subsidies if the corporation would bring 50,000 jobs to town with it. The New York City half of the new headquarters will be located in the Long Island City, Queens neighborhood. But the city's negotiations with Amazon have been super secret. Maritza Silva Farrell is Executive Director of ALIGN, an alliance of New York community groups and labor organizations. She doesn't trust Amazon one bit.
I would say that this announcement has come for many people in the city, particularly the folks in Long Island City, as a big surprise. There's two big problems here. One is that the community members in the area have not been basically consulted around this idea at all. The second biggest problem is the amount of different kinds of subsidies that this company will be receiving. We're talking about $3 billion that the company will receive to open up their headquarters, the second headquarters in New York City. This means that the Long Island City neighborhood will be heavily impacted by not only the way the quality of life will be, but also in terms of how much this will be impacting the infrastructure of that neighborhood and the city as a whole. Today, we are already experiencing a huge housing crisis. Homelessness is the biggest issue in our city. We are experiencing a huge problem with our subway system. The infrastructure that we have needs some care. We need funding for this kind of infrastructure. We are in opposition to the state and the city agreement to bring this wealthiest company, the wealthiest corporation in the world to come to the city with this amount of subsidies. And lastly, in a time when we also need education and public education in our city is critical, we are not investing on that. Instead, what the government and the state at the city level are doing, using this trickle-down economy concept to say we're going to create 25,000 jobs. We don't know who will be accessing to those jobs potentially will be getting paid $150,000 a year. And the community is already experiencing a lot of issues in terms of how much the access to training, how much access to the tech industry it is in the city. So it's a huge problem in all fronts. And we have a coalition of community and labor that has come together to say this isn't a fair deal for our New Yorkers. Amazon cannot come into our city and bully themselves into it, and for the government, for our government, to allow it. So we're very concerned and really upset about what the results of those negotiations have been.
Yes, these giveaways and subsidies to big corporations are justified on the basis that they paved the way for economic development. But the jobs often go to people who don't even live in the impacted communities, while the costs are borne by the taxpayers. And as you said, the negotiations between the city and the huge corporation, Amazon, were done in secret without input from the people.
That is right. And one more thing I will say, just to bring this to perspective in terms of the track record of this company. They are the bigger employer, perhaps, in Seattle. And while Amazon has become the top employer, as we know it, most of its employees do not have high-pay tech jobs. So that's another thing to consider. And accordingly to a company, the company's 2016 Employment Opportunity Report, we know that less than 4% of people in managerial or professional jobs at this company are folks of color, Black, from the minorities, while 30% of the workers in the low-wage jobs at the company are Black. Right, so they are definitely creating some huge issues in Seattle. They are contributing to the housing crisis there. And all of that to say that Amazon hiring practices may even deepen the racial divide in the city's workforce. This is only in Seattle. So we need to understand really how this company functions and the detrimental impact that their model will have in our city.
Your organization has calculated that the subsidies and giveaways in New York amount to about $112,000 for every job that Amazon claims it's going to create. That kind of money, besides not having been okayed directly by the people, could certainly be devoted to lots of other purposes.
That is totally right. I mean, we also know that additionally, Amazon is somebody who is not a trustworthy corporation. They have made promises in other parts. The Seattle case is the one that keeps coming up a lot in terms of like how some of those jobs that they offered that were going to be created were going to be good jobs. We're seeing the impact in terms of the standards of the workforce across the supply chains, where workers are pushed so hard that sometimes they didn't even have time to go to the bathroom. They don't have bathroom breaks. There has been issues in the facilities that they actually have, where there has been reports that ambulances have actually gone into the locations where they have their warehouses, right? So there is a lot of issues in terms of the model and the standards that this company overall has. And it is inconceivable for a city like New York City to basically blindly hope and wish that this company will be helping our city thrive when we already have seen the results of the model of the trickle-down economy, where we give money for economic development through the same Excelsior tax giveaway that it's at the state level. We've seen how that has happened in other moments through the years. Money is given away to corporations. They hope that jobs will be created. Jobs are created for a little bit, and then the companies just immigrate out, and then they leave the low-paying jobs in those neighborhoods and those communities. That's a dynamic that has happened for too many years, and now we're falling back into the traps of this kind of corporation.
New York City, of course, is among those places that leads the nation in income and wealth inequality and in inequalities in political power.
That is right. And the values that we have here in New York are to ensure that our communities are going to be sustainable, that we protect the workforce that we have, that we encourage and ensure that people are getting the education that they need. And for that to be a reality, we have to invest in our education, in our public education. We got to make sure that that happens rather than continue with the giveaway. Additionally, I'd like to just point out that we are living in a climate change crisis. So we know and it's reported that through the 100% renewable energy that Amazon's operations, including the warehousing, the data management, logistics, and delivery, all require an immense amount of energy. According to reports by some of the leading environmental groups in the country, they have also identified that Amazon has lagged behind its competitors on expanding its use of renewable energy sources. And we are a city that are actively moving more and more to ensure that we move to a renewable energy where less fossil fuels are going to be using. So we know that with Amazon, we're going to be actually going back in terms of our efforts as to how we are advancing these goals of like zero waste, goals of reducing emissions in our city and protecting the health of our communities and our workforce. So those are the things that also I feel like need to be highlighted. If the company really does not bring anything good to wherever they go, in concept, it's a good soundbite to say we're going to create 25,000 jobs. Unclear for whom and unclear how specifically that will happen. Lastly, even more concerning is that what we have as an agreement between the company and our elected officials is only an MOU. It's not even a memo of agreement that they have. They don't have any binding agreement. This MOU is not binding, and the company can easily turn back in any commitment that they have made with us, whether it is through the union construction jobs that they have said they will do. Surprisingly, they will do that. I'm sure the governor and the mayor actually had to press for that. But all of those union jobs that they are offering right now, it's a good thing. The problem here is that who knows if they're going to be backtracking on their promises, because there is nothing binding that we can hold them to. And the only thing that they're trying to do is just sort of get a nice talking point on the press. We have the resources to be able to invest right now. The state will invest and we will get some revenue in some point. Unclear how specifically that revenue will be given to our communities. So it's a big concern for all of us, and we're going to continue organizing to ensure that this company does not come into our neighborhoods without being accountable.
Yes, let's spend a little more time with this issue of democracy. How can it be tolerated that these kinds of discussions with a mega corporation continue down into fine detail and are then presented as a fait accompli without any public discussion whatsoever?
That's right. Like, I think that's the way these companies function, and that's the way they make, they do business. This was an agreement with literally three men in the room. And that is not the way we do business in our city. That's not the way that we want our elected officials to represent us. So I think this actually is another example as to how they are basically steamrolling themselves into our neighborhoods, into our communities, and our government just basically rolling out the red carpet for them to do so. It's inconceivable and unacceptable, we say, no matter how much they want to turn this into like a great economic development solution. I think the solutions are in our community. The solutions are in the taxpayers who are constantly paying their fair share. Corporations like Amazon should be paying triple of what we pay. And instead, they are getting giveaway, they're getting a cutback. It's like, I can't even believe how is that we're giving this to a company that is considered very recently, like the one of, I think it's $1 trillion value. It's the richest company in the world. And Jeff Bezos is actually the richest man in the world. And here we are, as a taxpayer money, as a taxpayer funder, I pay my taxes every year. Just hearing that my taxpayer money is going to be going to this multimillionaire guy is really something that I can't even swallow, with the conditions that they're going to create some jobs and build up some infrastructure that at the end of the day will also, I just mentioned, the housing issue in Long Island City is already difficult. As soon as the announcement from Amazon came through, we know that there is already speculation in Long Island City about how the cost of housing is going to be increasing. That's another problem. Senator Gennaris at the press conference yesterday actually mentioned that he knows that the parents in this neighborhood are like basically concerned because there is not enough seats for kindergarten kids to be able to access to the schools, right? We should be focusing on that. The other piece is around transit. We know that right now, just in Long Island City, there is about 24,000 riders every single day. With the increase of this development, we know that that would actually have a burden in our subway system that is crumbling, right? And lastly, the concerns from the city council has been about not actually being able to be part of this process and land use process that usually allows for the city council to be involved and being able to have a say on what gets to be built in the neighborhood that they represent. Council member Jimmy Van Bramer spoke at the press conference that we had yesterday, and that was one of the things that also for him was very concerning. See how our mayor actually allow for this to happen in a way that the city council has no power over what the decisions have been made. We will have a chance perhaps to do some environmental impact review, and that will be the end of it. Everything else is coming through the state, and everything else is managed by Amazon and how they wanted to just have this deal done. So it's outrageous that our own city elected officials do not have a say as to how these kind of companies can or cannot come into our neighborhoods.
Amazon is also in line to get a huge $10 billion CIA cloud maintenance contract. It's already got a $600 million contract with the CIA. How do you feel about your city becoming a hub of a big component of the deep state?
I mean, similarly to what I feel about everything else, it's outrageous. I feel that this company has no right to come to our city, to our state, and set up the conditions in which they wanted to come in. The reality is that Amazon needs New York more than what New York needs Amazon. We know that, and we cannot kid ourselves and imagine that this company is going to be doing good for us. This is the kind of company that bullies our communities, that bullies our workforce, that bullies our government to just get in with excuses that they are the future. They are so much the future that they're actually destroying what we have built for many years.
That was Maritza Silva Farrell speaking from New York City. When we hear the term liberation theology, most of us think of the Christian religion, but there are liberation theologians in the Muslim faith as well. Shadab Rahimtullah is a Muslim liberation theologian who teaches at the University of Jordan. He's the author of a new book titled Quran of the Oppressed, Liberation Theology and Gender Justice in Islam. Professor Rahimtullah says pro-poor, pro-equality, and pro-peace Islam is part of the global Muslim conversation.
It's moving beyond simply saying that Islam is being misrepresented, because that carries the assumption that there is a real, true representation of Islam. I'm not saying that there are not authentic readings of the Muslim faith, but it's not simply an object that has been misrepresented. That object is shaped by people, and those people would be Muslims. And those people live in an unequal society. So what we actually have here is a battle over shapers, a battle over the meaning and implications of Islam. And so liberation theology is about reclaiming the voice of shapers from below, people at the bottom of society, on the margins of society, who are saying, this is what the Quran means in my own lived experience and context, and this is what it has to say about social justice.
Well, certainly in Black America, we're familiar with variations on liberation theology in Islam. Mm. But we're given the impression, certainly since 9/11, that political Islam in the larger world is dominated by very conservative theologies and politics.
No, absolutely. And in practice, those theologies and movements are very diverse. They're very diverse across a very wide class spectrum, across a very wide gendered and sexual spectrum. But at the same time, again, I mean, in what context do we understand Islam? In what context do we understand religion in general? And you're absolutely right. I mean, in the Black experience, and specifically in the Black Muslim experience, you can see how Islam has been reinterpreted as a religion of protest. And what this book is saying is that, look, this is a global phenomenon. One of my case studies out of the four is a Black American woman, a scholar. But the other three case studies are situated in South Africa, Pakistan, and India. So this is something that's happening throughout the Muslim world, in which Muslims approaching the sacred text discern a God of justice who stands in solidarity with the oppressed.
Well, tell us about movements that we might recognize that are protagonists of this liberation Islam.
Well, I think actually that in the context of America, I think a great example is actually Iman, the Inner City Muslim Action Network in Chicago's south-southwest side. They are focusing on social justice, workers' rights, providing health care to disenfranchised youth and people in general in the inner city. And they're doing it as Muslims. They're doing it through their reading of the Muslim faith as a calling that is not simply vertical between a believer and her God, but horizontal. That is the relationships between people and people moving beyond simply the relationship between myself and my co-religionist, but people in general. So I think in the American context itself, you have some great examples. Another example would be Musawa. So in Arabic, Musawa just means equality. Musawa refers to a Muslim feminist movement that comes out of a very influential movement called Sisters in Islam in Malaysia. And Musawa is basically calling for equality in Muslim personal status law throughout the Muslim world. So issues of inheritance, child custody, domestic violence, and so forth. And they are calling for these rights through a liberative reading of the Quran and Islamic texts.
And of course, these movements come right up against the entrenched elites in those countries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And those entrenched elites are not using a secular counter discourse, but a religious counter discourse. So what we actually have here is what the Iranian revolutionary Ali Shariati back in the 60s called religion versus religion. And I really think that is the fundamental dynamic when we talk about Islamic liberation theology. The interface, the threshold, is not between the religious and the secular, but between the religious and the religious, specifically a religion of establishment that is comfortable walking through the corridors of power and wants to keep the status quo the way it is, and a religion of the oppressed, a Quran of the oppressed that speaks from the margins and wants to shake up that status quo.
And within this struggle within Islam, where does the Iranian revolution and the current Iranian state stand?
That's a great question. So the Iranian revolution was fundamental throughout the Muslim world, and indeed the world as a whole, in bringing religion back to the table, because many social scientists were deeply influenced by modernization theory. And a big assumption in modernization theory, if you look at the works of Daniel Lerner and so forth, was that with political development, you will actually see religion move out of the public sphere and into the private space. And the Iranian revolution shook that up. It was the largest popular revolution in the last quarter of the 20th century. So firstly, it challenged that. Secondly, it brought in a lot of liberative discourses into the Muslim world. And here, Ali Shariati is absolutely fundamental. You can see Ali Shariati's works in the works of Muslim liberation theologians. You can see Ali Shariati's works in the works of Muslim left, such as Ihsan Elayajik in Turkey. He's been very influential. Now, what we've seen since the Iranian Revolution in 1979 is actually a liberalization of radical religion. In fact, far worse than that, a conservatization of a liberalized radical religion. So you actually see an Islam of the center when you look at the Iranian Republic, in which religion is being used to put down internal dissent and to crush the voices from below. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier, which is this idea of religion versus religion. Before the revolution, in the midst of the revolution, we see a religion of the margins. And then in the same country, 20 years later, we see that transform into a religion of establishment.
And of course, the most aggressive Islam in the world today is Wahhabism, centered in Saudi Arabia and fueled by the vast riches of that elite.
Absolutely, absolutely. But at the same time, I would add that Wahhabism itself is a complex phenomenon. And I say this as a progressive. I say this as someone who is, you know, I'm a liberation theologian. I'm at odds with Wahhabi teachings and practices. But in practice, Wahhabism is actually very diverse and complex. And quite a few Wahhabis that I've met are actually political pacifists. So we do need to appreciate that even conservative establishment religion is not a monolithic phenomenon.
So we see this struggle going on within Saudi Arabia itself?
I think to some extent. But to be frank, I think the locus of liberation theology in Islam is actually outside the Arab world. Many of us assume that Islam is Arab and Arab is Islam, Muslim is Arab, Arab is Muslim, but Arabs only constitute about 11 to 15% of the Muslim majority world. And I actually stress this in my class on Islam and human rights at the University of Jordan, that if you want to really study Islam and human rights, liberation theology, feminist theology in Islam, you need to move beyond the Arab world and actually look at South Asia, Southeast Asia, Iran, Turkey, South Africa, and American Islam, because these are the spaces in which you have protest-driven discourses emerging in the name of Islam and texts like the Quran.
The biggest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia. But how Absolutely. Strong how strong is this, shall we say, progressive Islam in that country?
I don't know for sure. I would suspect not very strong, although there is important work being done on liberative readings of Islamic texts in Indonesia, particularly in terms of the hadith or the prophetic tradition. You hit a very important point. Liberation theology is on the edges of Muslim scholarship. It is not at the center. And I think one of the great challenges of progressive approaches to religion in whatever faith tradition is to take those radical teachings and to actually mainstream them without losing their radical content. And I think that is a project that lies ahead for any theologian who is committed to social justice. You know, how can we stop preaching to the converted and actually take these ideas and put them in the mainstream seminaries, but again, without losing their radical content?
Here in North America, very little attention is paid to Islam south of the Maghreb, south of North Africa.
Absolutely.
But much of
Absolutely.
Black Africa is Islamic. And AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, seems to be at war with much of it.
In terms of liberation theology and Islam, the South African experience has been fundamental. And here we can see how, you know, numbers don't necessarily translate into scholarly production and social impact. I mean, the South African Muslim community is percentage-wise very small. It's very old. It goes back a couple of centuries. But in terms of intellectual production, it has been fundamental. And here, the engine for that has been the anti-apartheid struggle. If you look at the luminaries of Islamic thought from South Africa, they were all involved intimately in the South African anti-apartheid struggle, and that provided the social framework for their liberative readings. So absolutely, I mean, fundamental to engaging Islam and human rights is to move beyond the historic heartlands of the Muslim world, which would be the Arab world.
If liberation theology in Islam, as in Christianity, is political, what do you think politically the mission is in North America and Europe and elsewhere for Islamic liberation theologians and laypersons?
That's a great question. So just speaking for myself as a Muslim liberation theologian, I think the political objective of Islamic liberation theology and liberation theology as a whole has to be an institutional objective. It's not just talking about social justice as rhetoric, and certainly not talking about social justice as charity, as acts of goodwill. For me, social justice has to be embodied institutionally in a strong welfare state that is committed to accessible quality education, free university education, free healthcare, a strong security net for those who cannot meet a certain financial threshold. That is, for me, what social justice means. It is an institutional expression. It is expressed through a state that would not be different from anywhere between an outright socialist regime to a welfare state such as Britain or Canada or France, although we can see that all of these states are under attack by neoliberalism.
In Syria, we, of course, get a picture through the U.S. corporate media of the Ba'ath government as being locked in some kind of death struggle with Islam as a whole. That is an Arab nationalist regime in Damascus. Is that an accurate picture?
Yeah, I think that's a fair picture. You know, I mean, the rise of a very conservative understanding of Islam as represented by the Islamic State has nothing to do with theological discussions per se. It's a direct result of the breaking down of law and order in Iraq, which was a direct result of the American occupation in 2003. That destabilized Iraqi society, that created this type of deeply entrenched sectarianism that then spilled over into neighboring Syria. So the reality of empire, and American empire in particular, is fundamental to understanding what is happening right now in Syria and in the Arab world as a whole.
in Afghanistan in the 1980s, as is well known today, Saudis, the U.S. CIA, and the regime in Pakistan combined to create what some of us observe was the first international network of jihadism.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the imperial origins of the very groups that, quote unquote, we are trying to destroy is complete hypocrisy. As you said, I mean, the CIA was fundamental and the Pakistani Secret Intelligence Service were fundamental, as were Saudi money, in producing militant, extremely conservative Islamist movements in Afghanistan to fight off Soviet influence. And no, I couldn't agree more. There is a politics to not only talking about Islam, but actually shaping it imperially on the ground. And as long as we don't see that imperial intervention, we will not have a clear picture of what is actually going on.
And what role could this liberationist Islam play in reconciliation in Syria?
I don't know what role Islamic liberation theology can play in terms of Syria, because I think that is a geopolitical situation that has to do with a genuine democratic revolutionary movement from the inside, and at the same time, imperial intervention on the part of the U.S. and other powers in trying to undercut the very regime that is being protested against. So it's a very complex and messy scenario. I don't know if Islamic liberation theology can have something directly to say about that, because it's actually not a theological situation. For me, that is a fundamentally imperial situation. But on that note, I think this is very important. Connecting this to your earlier question on Afghanistan, any Islamic liberation theology has to be first and foremost an anti-colonial theology, a theology that sees the trappings of empire in any discussion about Islam today. So it would have to be first and foremost an anti-colonial theology that is always suspicious of any type of discourse of peace, of anti-militancy, and actually asking who is having this, who is starting this discussion, on whose terms are we having this discussion, and whose interests are secured by pursuing this discussion in the first place. As a closing thought, I just want to emphasize something that I touched on in the beginning, that religion doesn't fall out of the sky, whether we're talking about Islam or any faith tradition, or for that matter, any tradition, secular, religious, or otherwise. Every phenomenon, every tradition is shaped by people, and people pursue their interests. So when we talk about Islam, for me, the fundamental question is the who question. Whose Islam are we talking about? Are we talking about the Islam of the powerful or the Islam of the oppressed? Or are we talking about a complicit Islam of the in-between? And for me, that is really what it's all about. Understanding that religion does not just exist, but that it is shaped, and therefore that it can be reshaped in order to pursue the interests of humanity as a whole. And that is really what the message of liberation theology is. When we think of theology, we think of a vertical relationship between a believer and her creator. Liberation theology is saying that the vocation of the believing human being is a horizontal vocation. It is a commitment to your fellow human being, irrespective of that person's faith, tradition, or background. The struggle to God is a horizontal struggle towards your fellow human being. And that is the message of liberation theology.
That was Muslim liberation theologian Shadab Rahimtullah. The nation's best-known political prisoner, Mumia Abu-Jamal, has filed a report for Prison Radio. It's about a man who knew too much.
Mike is a young man in prison who uses his time studying so that when he leaves, he'll have something to contribute to his family and his community. He studied cooking when he was in high school and went on to being certified in this culinary art. He's since studied business, electronics, and other areas to lift his levels of skill. He applied for a Pell Grant at the state prison in Mahanoy to take a college course in business. But guess what? Prison officials denied his application. Why? Because, they said, he knew enough. Therefore, he didn't need it. Unbelievable. When prisoners come to prison, one thing and one thing only stops them from returning to prison: education. The more you know, the less you'll find yourself returning to the dead end of prison. And it isn't like the classrooms here are bursting at the seams. For out of 20 men who initially applied for Pell Grants and college courses, about 5 have continued in their studies. The rest, they've dropped out. Education really works against recidivism. Maybe that's why they really don't want Mike to go to college. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.